Welcome to the Recovery Stories Podcast, bringing you stories of hope, healing, and triumph over the bondage of addictions, mental health struggles, trauma, and dysfunctional family systems. Our courageous storytellers have chosen to live their journey out loud in order to show others that they don't have to suffer in silence. The stories you will hear are raw, real, and may involve graphic and triggering content. This podcast is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health's Rooted Alumni Community. If you or a loved one are struggling, have questions, or are ready to take the next step, call our admission center at 888-648-4098 or visit us online at www.promisesbehavioralhealth.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Rooted Recovery Stories. My name is Patrick Custer and I'm your host. I'm so excited each and every one of you are tuning in with us live or on replay. It is National Pride Month and I am so excited to be here and talking with one of our most special guests that I'm so excited to have this conversation with LGBTQ plus advocate and a queer theology enthusiast, author, teacher, social media influencer, thought leader, and founder and CEO of NUMA, a spiritual intelligence organization that equips people in theology, spirituality, and faith. Welcome, Mike Maeshiro.
Thank you, Patrick. Wow, that's quite a mouthful of an introduction. That's a lot.
It is. Thanks. You know, I really like to, I have a paradox about intros for people. For me, because I want to include as much as I can to talk about some of the awesome highlights of them, but I also don't like condensing somebody down to this is who and what they are, you know, because we have an hour to talk about all the things, Mike Maeshiro, though. So, I'm excited to kick things off.
Likewise, I'm honored to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, you know, being Pride Month, you know, we're going to be talking about lots of things that make our community great and awesome, and also things that we struggle with. And I wanted to really flush through your story from the very beginning, but there's a theme. And I refer to it as kind of a death by a thousand cuts, little t trauma, cultural issues, stigma. I got a definition that I kind of like, and I want to talk about the definition of emotional trauma being the end result of events or experiences that leave us feeling deeply unsafe and often helpless. It can result from a single event or be a part of an ongoing experience, such as chronic abuse, bullying, discrimination, or humiliation. And I think for so many of us in the LGBTQ plus community, automatically applies, you know, what I just said. For and sure. One of the reasons why I'm so excited about having this conversation with you is because you've got a very unique perspective on your background and choices you made along the way into adulthood that framed a lot of this for you. So setting the stage is set. I would love to start off with where you came from, family life, where were you born, all that jazz.
Great. Wow. Yeah, we're going back. Okay. That's awesome. So I was born to a Japanese man and a Caucasian woman. So two different cultures were like, my dad was raised in Japan and then moved to the States when he was like 20 something. So two different cultures in my home, but I was born on Guam, which is a U.S. territory, but a Chamorro island. This is an island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So the culture I was around, like around me outside of my home, was different than the two cultures I was being raised with in my home. So I was already what they call a third culture kid. And so that's the setting that my life like set it out from. There was already so much blending and like adaptation that I just had to do from a young age out of survival. Because when I went to school, other people's parents and their attitudes and their perspectives were different than my parents and my home. And then my parents had their own, you know, unique version of how they thought things should go. And so we got to continue to compromise and adjust and make do with all of that. So adapting to other people's perspectives or values was a normal thing for me from the get-go. Before my sexuality ever even became a thing I was aware of, I was already like learning how to pay attention to what other people valued, how they thought about things, what they wanted, what success looked like in their perspective, and just like learning how to continue to accommodate other people's, you know, worldviews and all that. I didn't know this was true until way later in my life, but I looked back and I'm like, whoa, this was normal from the beginning. Like I had to do this from a very young age. And so I, at this point, I think it's a strength, but it definitely was like a thing I had to like figure out and survive, you know?
Yeah.
So then I, you know, I started noticing that I was different than the other boys. You know, like I was a lot more sensitive than most other boys around me. I didn't love the roughhousing and the fighting and the trying to prove yourself physically. I was a lot more intuitive and emotional and like sensitive. I remember being very in tune with other people's feelings and wanting to like minimize suffering and not cause harm to other people. I wouldn't have had words like this back then, but that's, you know, my driver and motive very much framed how I perceived things and the kinds of people I chose to spend my time with. And so that was like, I was like, okay, I'm not normal in these ways, but it's fine. And I did the best I could to try and be another, like all the other boys. I started noticing when Disney started putting movies out, like, I'm experiencing these movies differently than the boys are. I don't care about like Micro Machines and like, you know, all these like these boy type shows, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But I was very interested in The Little Mermaid and Barbie and, you know, as a boy, which wasn't normal. And my older sister was a tomboy and she was rough and aggressive. And I think she exhibited a lot more quote unquote masculine traits than I did. So there was some weird juxtaposition there too. Mm-hmm. So anyway, it wasn't until I was 10 that I had this conscious existential moment that I realized the way that I was, we had a word for, and it was gay. I was like, oh crap, I'm gay. Like that's why I'm different. Like that's what sets me apart in these particular things that I've been conscious of for a while now. And it was a dreadful moment, right? It was terrifying. It was embarrassing. I was just afraid, mostly because of my upbringing in the Baptist denomination, right? My parents got saved when I was 4. And so they started taking me to church and I learned that if I don't accept Jesus in my heart, I'm going to hell for eternity. So I was like, I'll take Jesus. And then I learned through that journey that gay people were evil and going to hell and they were gross and abominable and whatever. So once I realized that I was one of those abominable people, that was a dark secret that I got to carry and hide and whatever. And then when I was 12, my best friend and I started fooling around when we did like sleep over at each other's houses. And that lasted for like a couple of years. And no, we didn't talk about this with anybody, not even each other. It was never a spoken word about that.
Wow, so when it happened, it happened. But there was no dialogue.
Yeah, it was always in the dark at night, you know, in the bedroom. And then in the morning, it didn't happen. Like that never took place. And we just were two bros, right? And I mean, you think back to that too. And I'm like, how dysfunctional, you know, is that? Like how strange. And yeah, anyway, so that lasted for like 2.5 years. And that was pretty formative because I mean, it wasn't just like a physical thing for me. I was in love with this person. And so that I can't speak to his experience, but for me, I was definitely like infatuated is probably a good word, you know, and this person was like the most important, safest, most intimate relationship that I had. And then when I was 14, 15, I went to Bible camp over the summer and the speaker just spoke about sexual immorality and impurity and homosexuals came up at some point and I freaked out. I was like, this guy's going to know that I'm gay and he's going to expose me to everybody and my life's going to be over. And so I got kind of shaken up by that. And I decided at that camp, I got to end this relationship. And a few months later, I finally like was able to pull away from that person and just stopped. We didn't talk about it. I just stopped inviting him to things. I stopped accepting his invitations. I started hanging out with other people, just shifted out, you know? And then I basically went deeply into the closet and became like a sexless monk throughout my high school experience. So I don't know. That's where I started. Yeah.
Man, that was a very thorough intro. And you know, I just to go back, I wanted to ask when you put yourself back in the shoes of when you first realized, oh, we've got a word for what I am and it's gay. What did hearing that term ever, even when it wasn't being said towards you, what did that feel like? What did that feel like? Are you able to describe that process for you?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I don't know if I noticed right away, but later, it's kind of weird because I mean, I think the word indoctrination comes up in my commentary around church and queer people and all that and theology, because you're at such a, most of us who grew up in the church, we started at a really young age and we didn't have the mental faculties to even protest or question the things that we were being told about reality or God. So from a very young age, I learned, oh, gay people are not the way they're supposed to be. Something's wrong with them and God doesn't love these people. Mm-hmm. And so that was like, it was a bummer. I felt bad for those people. I was like, oh, that's sad. I knew I needed to stay away from them. So to find out that I was one of those abominable people, right, was a shock. But before I realized that was me, the attitude was like, oh, it sucks for them. It's kind of like, it sucks to be a murderer or a rapist or a child molester. It sucks to be a homosexual was kind of the same category and mindset, right? Of like how you socially perceived those people. And I didn't know those people. I didn't know any actual gay people. They were always like somewhere else. And I'm sure there were gay people around me, but they were just deeply closeted. So I didn't know that they were gay. So I didn't have a ton of need to have a strong, like clarified opinion about gay people for a while because I didn't know any of them. Like they weren't around. Like we were very exclusive in how we lived our lives, very easily condemning of other people who were different from us. And by us, I mean the church I was part of, right? So it was mostly like this distant, weird creature somewhere else in the world that was evil, that was going to hell. It's like a bummer for those people. We're not them. Let's stay away from them. It was kind of the gist of my attitude.
Yeah. So your answer to staying safe was next. What was it that you chose to do in your path?
When I realized I was gay.
Yeah. Well, and I guess cause so at this point where we've kind of like moved to, you're like a middle teenager, right? Like,
yeah. Also in high school. 15. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So my path to safety was I'm not gay. My parents didn't let us date when I was in high school, which wasn't normal. My parents were strict in this one particular area for some reason. I mean, in a few areas, and this was one of them. So that was my beard for high school. I wasn't allowed to date. And so that answered why I wasn't dating all these amazing girls who were interested in me. Like I just wasn't allowed to date. And so my response to the being gay and the safety piece was I surrounded myself with broken people. I became very interested in helping other kids who were like suffering and maybe traumatized or dealing with rejection or depression or whatever. Because I had a really fateful moment in middle school where I got in a big fight with my mom and then I locked myself in the bathroom and like went to a very dark place just because like that was in the middle of me being in my gay relationship that was closeted and I was going to church and I was this upstanding, humble, Christ-like leader at my youth group, right? And that was such a juxtaposition to this dark secret that I was carrying. And so from there, I basically felt so unknown and like separated from the people that I, you know, considered my family and my community. So in that fateful night in the bathroom, I actually wanted to die. I wasn't thinking about how to kill myself, but I was absolutely praying to God, like, please don't let me wake up tomorrow. Let me get hit by a bus or like, I don't know, struck by lightning. I don't care. Die in my sleep. I just don't want to live anymore. I don't want to be here. Like the idea of my future felt more torturous and painful than just being dead. Which is such a dark, scary, you know, awful place to go. But that's where I was. And so I sobbed for a few hours. And that night, in the bathroom, I basically decided I will never let anybody who knows me or whom I know end up in a place in their life where they feel like no one in their life knows them or would be willing to listen or meet them where they were. Yeah.
I just wanted to interject if I could right here. Yeah. You just spoke to something that I think so many people diminish in their own story, which is the fact that we have these definitions of suicidality, right? And the acuity of a suicidal person. And I think in mainstream culture, we tend to, when someone or ourselves have been in a place that you just described, where you're like, I don't want to wake up tomorrow. But I don't have means and a plan to execute that strategy myself. Yeah. And I think that we oftentimes diminish that scenario down to being something that just doesn't get acknowledged as being suicidal. But that is suicidality. Mm. It's just in a different form.
Yeah.
And so, you know, being in that place, having reverence for the space that you came from there, calling it what it is. I think so many people, without giving proper recognition to what we've been through, what we've come from, I think that so many people can relate to that. And I just kind of wanted to shed some light on like that is a thing that's real. that those grips of despair are very, very, very real, as you can attest. So, yeah, I just wanted to kind of point that out and say, you know, that moment was huge.
Huge. So intense. And it's weird, like thinking back on that experience, because I was writing some memoir type posts for my coming out announcement, and I was like revisiting some of my experiences, and that was one of them. And I was like, man, it's weird to think like I was suicidal at one point. I didn't think about myself that way. Cause when you hear people like who struggle with suicidal ideation or whatever, you have this idea about those people. And I was like, oh my gosh, I was one of those people. That was where I was, and I didn't talk about it. No one knew. But that happened to me, right? Like I was, anyway, so it's weird to have to like kind of remove the stigma, which somehow separates you from the experience because you look down on it. It's like, hey, it doesn't matter how you judge this. Like that, I was experiencing that. That happened to me, right? So totally. Yeah. It's, you can easily downplay it because, you know, like it's something that happened back then and you didn't, no one knew and whatever. But I'm like, if I'm being honest, that was like a low point for sure. And like, it's not a good space for anybody to be in, and that should never have happened and whatever. And yeah, it was intense.
Yep.
I don't remember what I was.
I cut you off.
No, you're good. You're good. Well, basically, part of your question was like, what was safety for me moving forward? Yes. And basically, it was like, I purpose in my own heart was like, I would not let anyone else that I knew end up in a bathroom like that. Like, I would be at least one person they knew they could call or text, and I would be willing to listen. I would meet them where they were, and I wouldn't judge them for what they were experiencing or feeling. And so that kind of changed. I think that experience like changed me a little bit in terms of like how I showed up in my relationships, my priorities, my willingness to interrupt or initiate into relationship. And then I absolutely followed through on that. Like I surrounded myself with a bunch of broken people in high school, and there's like a good and a bad to that. Like there were a lot of beautiful things and redemptive things that came out of that choice and the relationships I had and the things that happened in their lives. But then also like, I think part of that was coming from a low self image, you know, like I didn't believe I was worth being friends with someone who didn't need my help, who wasn't broken. And so that I got to work through all that, right? But that lasted for a few years, and it was nice and distracting. You know, I got to look like a saint whilst also not having to face my own closeted issues, my own inauthenticity and hiding from my own life. And I spent a few years in that place.
Did you, how did you acknowledge, or did you acknowledge the place of brokenness that you were in? And did you seek any type of help, like outside of the church, i.e. counseling or any?
No, I couldn't, Patrick, I could not seek help outside of whatever, because otherwise I'd have to admit something was wrong to myself and then to anybody else. And I had too much writing for me to be able to admit that. And I was functioning enough that it,
can you describe for me when you say I had too much writing?
Yeah, I had this reputation of being a leader in the church, especially. I was like charismatic, like I don't mean denominationally because I wasn't. I mean, personality wise, there was so much charisma that I was living my life with. That's just naturally, you know, who I am. And people were drawn to that. And I was like seen from like the older generation and my peers as like a person to emulate and an example and someone to follow or whatever. And I like fed off of that. It definitely like boosted my ego and gave me like a sense of self-worth and like significance. Right. So I was like addicted to that a little bit. And so like, if I were to be honest and admit that I wasn't doing well or that I needed help, then I would have to like lose that trophy or crown or whatever. And I didn't want to lose it. So my well-being was a secondary priority to my significance or like the praise of people in my life. And that sounds so petty, but it was absolutely true. Like that was, I was eating it, you know, like it was fueling me. So yeah.
Yeah. That was exactly what I was asking. I mean, you know, so often I think that is you just told in one way or another, so many people's story, whether they identify with the LGBTQ+ community or some other form of brokenness. So I just narrowed it down to about everyone. right. And when the brokenness happens and we're in this community, and I'm not saying all church communities necessarily, but when we're surrounded by this culture that is reinforcing
perfection. Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird to say perfection, but in a nutshell, it's what it is, because, there's an expectation to give everything over to God. God's going to handle it. And if your needs aren't met and it's not being handled, well, then how's your relationship with God at that point? Was that in your church environment? Would that be how you would describe it? Or like, what was the view on me as a person or child of God, my relationship with a higher power, and how that manifested?
Interesting. I think I can answer that question. Just because I've gone through such a radical transformation since that form of my Christianity that I'm like, can I remember that person and what they believed? I mean, the idea was that God loved us. There's grace for everyone. It didn't matter what you did. Like, God loved you. But once you know he loves you, then the conditions flood. And then you have to start living a certain way. You have to start adhering to certain standards or metrics. And if you failed to fill out in these certain social demonstrations of whatever things we specified, then you were sinning or, but at the end of the day, the problem wasn't sin. The real threat wasn't God removing his love from you. The real threat was losing face with your peers or from your leaders, like not being accepted by the white holy club of like the white hats, the people who were like, you know, the religious upright. If they didn't approve of you, that's the biggest threat. And I learned that. I think my parents inadvertently kind of instilled that in me, in their attitudes, and also just the way the culture was at church. So I hook, line, and sinker just like absorb that as a value system. I never really felt concerned about God's love for me or God not loving me. That wasn't ever really a threat to me. I think some people do feel that way and like experience that. That wasn't really my experience. For me, it was mostly position, status, influence, acceptance from people in the church that I was working for and peddling, you know, for. So yeah, so as far as God was concerned, like he and I were good. And I've always understood and related to God as a more empathetic, understanding, compassionate person. So I never felt like, oh, I need to make sure God and I are good, really. That wasn't my main priority. And if you would have asked me back then, it would have sounded different for sure. But as I look back, I'm like, my motive was not God. My motive was I need these people to approve of me. So
wouldn't you say though that is every 17-year-old? I mean, like at that age, I think it's ingrained in us as human beings to pursue. We are made to be a community, right? Like, so it would be abnormal if somebody wasn't doing things to pursue status, people, community, all those things that provide us the value in society, right? And your society just happened to be church.
Christian. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. So moving forward, I know the answer to this, but I can't remember what you said. When was the point where you had this pivotal moment of going to seminary or the Bible college that you did?
So it was about 18 when I encountered God for the first time. I had this radical, deeply spiritual experience that I had trouble putting words to, but was one of the realest things I'd ever experienced in my life. Met God for the first time. And it's hard to describe what God was like, but I mean, love was a deep, overarching, like overwhelming aspect to the person of God. Like love, right? And then like months later, I had another experience with God. And in that experience, essentially, God told me he wanted me to be gay, which I couldn't accept. I knew that wasn't true, or like I knew that wasn't biblical, or that Christians wouldn't accept that from me. So I was like, okay, he can say that. He can say whatever he wants, right? He's God. I'm shocked. This is going to have to be our little secret. I don't know what to do with that. And no one's going to know he said this to me. And then I had a couple other experiences like that. And eventually one of them was basically God saying to me, what are you doing here, Mike? You're not supposed to be here. I have something else for you. And I was working at a job in Portland when that happened. So my decision in response to that experience was, I have to get out of here. Not just my job, but I knew it meant like my family, my church, my community, my friends, my ministry, whatever, any of the things that I valued and was holding onto so tightly. Like God had something else for me. So I moved to Japan for 6 months and I did a missions like training, like a discipleship training school with youth with a mission in Japan. When I came back, a couple more radical experiences like that. And then I moved to Redding, California to pursue ministry school with Bethel Church. So that's, I basically like for about a year or so in my life, started having some pretty radical experiences with God that demanded actual choices and action in my life. And that moved me across the world and then down to Redding, California. That's the short version.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was your process through, if you could simply put, like what during that whole time, you know, you said God told you in the first process of him revealing himself to you, he said, you know, this is, I know who you are and this is your truth. You're not being that, right? Like, so in the meantime, during all of which, what you just described, are you just like, did you shelf what you had been told, or how, where was your mind and heart?
Yeah.
All of that.
Yeah. So I definitely shelved it. I think a little bit out of survival, a little bit out of fear, like terror, you know, like I didn't know where this was going to go. I believed that God had a plan and that eventually something would happen one way or the other. This was going somewhere. I just didn't know where. I didn't know what it was going to look like. The biggest obstacle to me responding in a surrendered way to what I heard from God was my theology, the leaders in my life, and the way I was told to read the Bible. These things were absolutely barriers to my sensitivity to the Holy Spirit. So as God continued to address my sexuality and continued to bring that up, it was over the span of 14 years, God addressed my sexuality like 9 times in these explicit, dramatic confrontation, encounter type experiences. And every time it was so intense, and I was repentant and like responsive to what God was saying and like so like grieved that I hadn't been listening and whatever. And then after that experience, I went back into the system and learned how to continue to perform and behave according to those ideas and standards, even though I was failing to honor what God was saying to me specifically about my sexuality. I didn't know what to say or what to do. I didn't know how to bring this up to leaders and not have them just absolutely run me over and tell me that wasn't God and tell me that I'm listening to a demon or that I'm making this up or that I wanted God to say that to me. Cause I didn't want God to say those things to me. Right. There was zero question that this was God. I just knew they wouldn't believe me and they would not honor those experiences as sacred as they were, like I needed them to. So I didn't share this with most people most of my life. I knew that this wasn't going to be regarded appropriately. So I protected it / avoided it. I shelved it for 14 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what were you doing at this point? You're at Bethel. Mm. How are you functioning? What is your day-to-day? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, let's unpack that.
Okay. So I did first and second year in the ministry school. A couple months into first year, I told a friend of mine, one of my fellow students who I looked up to and like kind of pulled in as like a fellow student mentor to me. I pulled her aside and I basically told her about my middle school experiences with my best friend, like that we were fooling around for a couple of years and that I, you know, it was with a guy. This was like homosexual activity. And I basically like asked her to pray for me and, you know, like help me not be gay, like pray the gay out of me, pray the gay away. Like literally that was like what I was asking her for. So she prayed for me and whatever, nothing happened. The next year in the middle of second year, so we're still in school together. I'm in the middle of worship. I got away from my friends physically because I just was miserable. Like I hated my life. I hated going to school. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I was doing there. I didn't know where I was going. Like I just felt so disoriented and lost and aimless. And I, in the middle of worship, that memory kept replaying in my mind of pulling my friend aside, asking her to pray the gay away. And it just kept looping. And I was like, God, are you trying to tell me something right now? Like, why is this, what's going on? Like, this is super distracting. I'm trying to worship. And the moment focused and in my spirit, I heard the voice of God. And he said to me, you trusted her with something that belongs to me. And there was like this protective, almost jealous, like rebuke, I guess would be the word. And immediately I knew that was true. I was reaching for someone else to give me something that God wouldn't. He was taking too long. He wasn't addressing this. He wasn't giving me what I needed here. So I was going to get it somewhere else. And I felt very exposed and convicted, and I had to clean it up. So I actually like told that person, I need space. We need to not be friends. The end of second year, I'm not trying to vilify this person, but this happened. She outed me to the pastors without telling me that she did that. God.
Wow.
So I got pulled into my pastor's office at the end of school, and he was like, so you've been single this whole year, you seem kind of hidden, what's going on there? I was like, yeah, but the short of the story is, like, I tried reaching out to my pastor 3 times throughout the year. He never responded to my emails or texts. So I just thought, he's so busy, I'm not gonna like be another nagging student to try and like, you know, add to his workload. So I just accepted, I won't talk to the pastor about this, that's fine, I'll try and figure out another way to get healed. And so by the end of the school year, I think he politically felt, or like, you know, within the school system, probably felt like, oh, my student. The short version is, I got kicked out of school on the last day of school. Graduation was in like 6 hours, and I got pulled into the principal's office, and they told me I was not graduating. And I was like, what? And I was trying to figure out, like, what? I was terrified. And basically, I found out a few years later, they believed, based on the rumors they were being told, that I was sleeping with other dudes and pretending like I was this upstanding ministry school student, but living this double life. Which wasn't true. I was like this sexless monk. I like barely had a sexuality to speak of because I was so repressed, which that's not natural. Like, anyway. So right. That was a really dramatic, like traumatic experience for me. And it was really painful. A few months later, I went back to the leader who kicked me out. Okay.
Wait, so a decision was made based on a perception that you were not even asked about.
Correct. I was not invited to clarify or like respond to certain accusations or ideas about me. It was all just assumed that I was guilty in doing these things, and the decision got made for me. And I was so like submissive back then, subservient, I think is a good word. Mm-hmm. Cause that's a value that's, you know, propagated in the church. Like being submitted to your leaders is a biblical value. It's like a way that you show you're a son and you're submitted to the Lord is by like letting them dictate your life in some ways. And so I was trying to do and be that from a sincere place, and it got me kicked out of school and like not represented and whatever. Yeah. So decisions got made for me that were based off things that weren't true. And the people who were making these decisions were not doing their due diligence to get the answers they needed to make informed decisions that were affecting my life, which is such a bummer. And I wish that was the only time that happened there, and it's not. Mm. And I wish I was the only person this happened to, and I'm not. Like, and that's not unique to Bethel. Like, this is true of like church leaders across the board. There's just, you know, a severe lack of accountability on the imbalance of power in these relationships. And anyway, so a few months later, I confronted the guy who kicked me out and was like, I saw a couple of different people and I was like counseled, like, hey, you need to address this with him. So I was like, hey, I don't know what happened here, but blah, blah. I told him my story. And he was like, I'm so sorry. He cleaned it up. He apologized. Anyway, there were a bunch of things on their end that just weren't going well and didn't get handled great. And he acknowledged that. And so that was like, I appreciated that. I got hired on staff at that church a few months later. The irony.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I started working at the church that like traumatized me. Anyway, I worked there for 6 years. And while I was working there, I also got involved with the school. I was volunteering for a while. And then I started teaching in the second year program on the gift of discernment. And my class started to grow in notoriety and influence. And I started leading mission trips for the school. And I started taking interns. And the weird thing is, like, the people who were in charge of those departments asked me if I would lead mission trips for them, asked me if I would take interns. Like, they wanted me to have more influence into whatever. I was like, great. And I just kept saying yes to these opportunities. So my influence just kept growing in this environment, in this system. And I'm traveling and speaking all over the world. People are flying me into all these different countries to teach about spiritual intelligence and the gift of discernment. And I loved it. It was like a passion. And I'm so thankful to this day still of all the experiences I got to have. But it was like this weird paradox,
right?
The more celebrated and like public and visible I became, the further away from my own authentic voice I was growing in terms of my sexuality. Like, it was becoming further and further away from me. And every once in a while, I would have this creeping dread. I'm like, I'm still gay though, and nobody knows. And nothing's changing. Like, I'm not becoming a little bit more attracted to women. The men aren't becoming less attractive to me. Like, this isn't budging. Right. When I got kicked out of school, I got put in the men's purity group. I got put in an inner healing prayer process.
For those who aren't familiar, could you describe what a men's purity group is for us?
Oh, God. Yeah. So they had a men's purity group where basically men who are addicted to porn or going to massage parlors or, like, you know, addicted to masturbation or were sleeping with prostitutes or cheating on their wives, like, or people who, and then people who were gay, all these people got lumped together into this, you know, this Monday night ministry space where they would come together and get into small groups and talk about their addiction and their shame and how they messed up that week and, like, have people hold them accountable. There was worship, there was a message, and it was so, like, I hated going because the atmosphere was so shame filled. Like, everyone, so many men in that room hated themselves and were so ashamed. And, like, you know, purity culture just has such nasty repercussions for people who take it seriously. And that room was filled with people who were being beaten down for being sexual. And the solutions that were being offered to these men, I'm like, it's not working. It's not a solution. There was some good, I don't want to just throw it all out. There were some great values that were being instilled for sure, but there was so much other stuff that I don't think we're lending toward life. And then all the gay men in the room, like, the leader of the whole thing would sometimes get up and confess to everybody, like, hey, I know you guys are here for different reasons. Those of you who struggle with same-sex attraction, I just want to apologize. I want you guys to know, like, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what to do with that. I don't know. And I'm like, well, what am I doing here? This is ridiculous. Like, anyways, I did counseling with some leaders. Like, I went through all these different things to try and fix my sexuality and get me to be the way I was supposed to. And the best way I could participate was to just keep repressing myself because none of the anything was working. And if I were to be more honest, I just get put into more rigorous stuff and none of it was budging anything. So I finally was just like, okay, I don't think these people can help me. I'm going to just get out of this. Like, I'm good. Thanks for that. I just won't have sex. I just won't have romance in my life. That's fine. I will handle it. Clearly this isn't working. So that was, like, I lived that way for years. And the more public I got, the less possible it was for me to be honest about that part of my life. And then there was a dramatic downfall.
Well, what set the stage? Okay.
So
let's dive right into that downfall.
Great. So I had, like, interns that I was leading from the school, right? I'm speaking, I'm traveling, I'm teaching in the school. Leaders in the environment are quoting me on social media. They're grabbing the stuff I'm writing and sharing it on their platforms. I'm just, like, very visible and celebrated. And then one day I'm on a business trip. So this is, like, separate from my ministry stuff. I'm on a business trip traveling to Florida, and on a layover, somebody DMs me on Instagram and they're like, hey, can I email you my testimony? And I was like, sure. And this is normal. Like, people do this sometimes. So I was like, sure. I pulled up their email while I was on my layover, and it starts off with, and I know this person's a Christian, and he goes, so I'm gay, ... And it's, like, this 2-page email of his testimony. And I was like, immediately, like, what? Like, what am I reading? This is so out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. Read the whole thing, shot him back an encouraging email. Hey, bro, thanks for sharing this. Glad you're being honest and getting to keep going, whatever. I was never, like, homophobic or anti-gay. I didn't ever really preach against queer people. I just avoided the subject as much as I could. My interns would sometimes bring it up. What do you think about this? Or what would you hear? And whatever. And I just advocated for grace and compassion and understanding, and very much, like, avoided having some kind of strong stance about what to do with someone's sexuality if they were queer.
Of course.
Well, and apparently that's not how everyone responds. Other closeted people who are in the religious environment tend to be, like, very anti-gay to compensate for their own insecurities. Right. So I've experienced people who do that. Like, when I came out, I had people come at me really intensely. And then as I continued to just, like, be visible about my process, a couple months later, people would DM me and be like, hey, I want to apologize for how I responded to you. I'm so sorry, blah, blah, blah. By the way, I've accepted that I'm a bisexual. I'm accepted that I'm gay. I'm like, oh my gosh. Like, how did you say what you said to me while you were gay? Like, to me, I'm like, I don't get that. But that is actually more common than I ever knew.
Sure.
So I just basically, like, avoided or downplayed needing to address this as much as I could, because I had a lot of value for grace for people. And I wasn't, like, trying to apply this to only certain kinds of dysfunction. I was like, hey, everybody gets grace from God. Mm-hmm. So anyway, by the time I got to my hotel room in Miami, I was a mess. I felt so rejected and sexual. I mean, like the term would be horny. I felt very horny and very gay, like in a way that I hadn't felt in a long time. I had a couple of spells throughout those years where I just felt very sexual, like something was trying to get out of me. And I'm like, ah. And I thought I'm just getting seized by sin, right? And temptation. And
right. It's Satan.
Yeah. The Satan was after me and like, oh, I'm getting attacked. And I couldn't tell anybody about this attack I'm experiencing because then they'd know how I was struggling, right? So I just didn't say anything to people. I just struggled quietly. So anyway, I'm getting hit with this spell of being a sexual, homosexual person, but also just felt so insecure and rejectable and unworthy. And it was so strong. I was like, what is happening to me? So I got out of my hotel room, went for a walk for a couple hours that night. And I was like, God, it's been 14 years since you told me you wanted me to be this way. And nothing has changed. He said to me, I want this to remain a little longer, was the verbiage that I heard. So I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know if he was going to change me eventually. I knew it was possible I was going to be this way for the rest of my life when I jumped on board and said, I'm good, let's go. So I'm over here like being this like double-minded, whatever. I'm like, God, it's been 14 years since you said you wanted this to be this way. What's going on? I am 32. I'm single. I'm visible, like people know me. I'm known by a lot of people. They're watching me, and it's awkward that I'm a 32-year-old single dude who's an eligible bachelor and I'm still single. What are we gonna do about this? Are you gonna do something? Do I need to do something? Like, what's happening? And he didn't say a word to me. And I just like got exhausted, just like, you know, let myself feel this pain, and there was no response. And then a few months later, it's February 1st, 2020. We're about to go into a global pandemic. I watched Taylor Swift's documentary on Netflix called Miss Americana. And halfway through that movie, she goes off about gay people and basically just like advocating for them. She's like, this woman, this politician wants to pass legislation that says that if you're a gay couple, or if you even look like you're a gay couple, you should be allowed to be kicked out of a restaurant. This is about right and wrong at this point, human rights. And I can't just sit back and do nothing. And when she ranted in that moment, something hit me, like a spiritual conviction struck me in my living room. I was alone. And I'm like, what is this? And I knew it had something to do with the gay thing, and like God was in this, but I didn't know what to do with it. So I left it alone. 2 weeks later, I am now processing a lot of pain in my life. I'm dealing with some weird backlash from leaders at Bethel at that time. I'm like trying to figure out how to diminish or like reduce my team, because I feel so deflated by the way I'm being treated by leaders there that I don't want to lead people anymore. But I've got this crew of a bunch of people who are on my team. I'm like, what am I supposed to, I'm not just going to cast these people aside, but what? So I feel burdened by that. Anyway, I'm working through some pretty serious like personal pain, and none of this has to do with my sexuality. And in the middle of me, like in my living room, just like processing this stuff out, I get hit with this story of Peter in Acts 10, where he goes up on the roof and falls into a trance. Like, it just hits me. I know this story. It's disrupting my process. So I pulled it up on my phone and just read the whole thing. He goes up on the roof, falls into a trance. A sheet comes down from heaven. And in the sheet is all these animals that Jewish people are not allowed to eat, right? It's forbidden for them to eat these kinds of creatures. And God says, rise, Peter, kill, eat. And Peter says, no, Lord, I've never eaten anything unclean. And God says, don't call anything unclean that I've made clean. This happens three times, and the sheet goes back up into heaven. Sorry. And again, in this moment, I feel that same spiritual conviction that I felt with Taylor Swift 2 weeks prior. I was like, oh, it's the thing again. It's happening again. What the heck? And I knew this was about like the gay thing. I was like, is God trying to tell me that being gay is acceptable now? Like, it wasn't, and now it is. Like, I'm like, that's quite the reach. I don't do this. I don't have enough to work with. So I'm going to leave this alone. 3 weeks later, I'm in the back of my neighborhood in this woods, and I'm literally yelling at the universe. I'm yelling. I'm so mad about what's going on with my career, with my ministry, with the leaders I'm under, with the way I'm being treated. It was like, it was so bad. And in the middle of this tirade, I again get interrupted, this time by a different passage of in the Gospels when Jesus is rebuking the teachers of the law. It happens in two different Gospels. So I pulled it up. And again, this stuff's in my head. Like, I know these passages, right? So I pulled it up and I read it. It starts with Jesus rebuking the teachers of the law. He says, you heap rules and requirements on the people without lifting a finger to help them. He goes off about prophets and their tombs and the hypocrisy of this generation and blah, blah. And at the end of it, he says, you prevent people from entering the kingdom while you yourselves refuse to enter. And by the time I finished reading that last bit, Patrick, I don't know how to explain this. I was alone in the woods. I got hit with this intense rebuke, like for my life. And it wasn't just me though. It hit me and everyone I was associated with when it came to ministry and theology and being a Christian and a leader and any of it. All of us, we were implicated. And I knew for the first time in, I don't know, maybe ever, I guess, we are wrong. And this is 100% about the queer community. We are wrong about how we've treated these people. We are wrong about how we perceive them. We are wrong about the stances we've taken. Our hands are dirty. We are not clean here. And forget anybody else, like I, you know, and I just like immediately in this moment realized this is God. I didn't realize this was God until this third time. But the moment I realized this was the voice of the Lord, everything changed. Because I'd been living my life. I think it had been 4 years since I heard God say anything to me about my life, my personal journey up to this point. And I don't recommend living your life without the voice of God. It's, if you're used to it, at least, like, it is not fun. It's really painful. And I was sparkly and killing it. I was crushing it in my life. I was doing such a great job. And I wasn't living. And so in that moment, I was like, oh, the voice of God, remember this? And I basically decided I'm going to grab every breadcrumb that this points to or touches. I'm going to run down every road I can find. I'm going to find his voice and I will not let this go. And so I was ready to lose everything because I just didn't want to keep doing what I'd been doing for the last several years. I didn't want any more of that success or that attention or that whatever at the expense of my own soul, basically, right? So I made a bunch of decisions like very quickly in that space. And I would call this repentance. I started changing my mind about how I had been participating because I needed to shift where I was and what I was doing. I had to like get out of that sinking ship, not to save myself, but to make good with God. And like Moses showed up in that headspace when he killed that Egyptian for beating on a Hebrew, right? Like there was that moment where he saw an Egyptian beating on a Hebrew and Moses killed that Egyptian. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is literally what I didn't do. Like Moses, out of his dignity and nobility, like rose up to defend his brother, mm-hmm. and me being benefited from Egypt and having a seat of power and like whatever, I let these queer people get beaten on. I knew this was happening and I let it happen. I allowed it on my watch, even though I was one of them. And I just felt so grieved, like deeply and intensely. And one of the things that came up to try and defend myself later in my process was like, I was like, God, I don't want to be a gay minister. I don't want to only speak to gay people. I don't only want to talk about gay things. I don't want that. And then Jonah shows up in my mind. And like, that's, I'm literally like the same attitude and posture as Jonah. He doesn't want to go preach to the Ninevites because he's afraid mm-hmm. they're going to repent and the kingdom will come to those people. And I'm like, what am I doing? I was like, how did I get to this place in my life where this stuff has become my jurisdiction or up to me? This is so inappropriate. And so anyway, there are lots of these moments I could tell you. It was such a journey of repenting and so specific and present and immediate. And I had to keep like, it felt like I started falling down a flight of stairs and I just was gaining momentum and getting more and more hurt the further I went. Just discovering all these ways that I was a hypocrite, that I was a coward, that I was lying to myself and a bunch of other people, that I allowed and tolerated injustice in front of me, that I like identified myself as a follower of Jesus and a preacher of the gospel. And yet this was going on in my heart and in my backyard, like so inappropriate. So I just then started like intentionally like having conversations with people. And I started listening to a bunch of voices who were affirming of queer people, whether they were Christian or not. I was like, I don't care. I just need to know anyone else saying something different than everything I've heard my whole life. And I broke out of that echo chamber and started listening to other people. And I was like, holy crap. We have no idea what's being said out here. These people are doing very quality work. These are very good points. These are very good questions. These are very good observations. We have no idea what we're talking about. This is embarrassing, just on an intellectual level, right? Just on a social justice level, forget anything else. So that, you know, set me off on this whole path and journey, and the stakes just kept getting higher and bigger. And I just got to grieve all the loss that I was about to experience. And I knew, so before I even came out to most of the people in my life, I was like, yeah, that won't happen anymore. I won't get to be this anymore. I won't have this anymore. People won't invite me for these things. Well, I just started becoming very aware of all the things I wasn't gonna get to do that I loved doing, but none of it was worth giving up, you know, intimacy with
God. Authenticity.
Yeah, authenticity. None of it was worth being myself and getting to breathe oxygen for the first time. None of that was worth that. So I just got to continue to grieve and like basically attend my own funeral before I was actually laid in the casket and just be like, okay, that's going to be gone. Okay, I won't have that anymore. Okay, they're not going to see me like this anymore. Ugh. And I just got to keep taking, but that was such an important process, right? And so I did all of that. And then I started coming out to a bunch of people in my life and they had their versions and they started living out my fears and like responding to me in the ways that I didn't want to have to experience. And, you know, I got to walk it all out and it was so painful. God, that was traumatizing. I still have moments where I like remember being at Bethel or certain leaders or conversations or positions I was in. And there's trauma around remembering that time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, I'm trying to blame Bethel for that. I was complicit. I said yes to things. Like, I, you know, they didn't do this to me. I agreed with what was there and whatever, but sorry, that's a lot of information, but that's like kind of like the gist of how this played out for me.
Yeah. Well, and that's, I mean, don't be sorry. That's exactly what I wanted to, you know, hear and have you talk about. Yeah. And so, okay, I want to move forward in just a second. So I want to table for just a second, but move forward in this. What that was like for you, that however uncomfortable it is, can we open that box a little bit in just a minute? But okay, so because I know we have so many people from varying walks of life and faith and all, you name it, in our audience, I would like to ask you how you, when you talk about discernment and hearing the voice of God, right? I grew up in a background where, you know, you and I have had these discussions and like, I know where you're coming from and we, you know, meet exactly at the same spot, you know, from the get-go. But how do you describe, like, listen, we've got, you know, you talk about a Baptist, a Methodist, anybody in the church, and everybody's got different definitions of how God is and shows up. Totally. Does he actually speak to us with words? Mm-hmm. Is it just a feeling? Or does he arrange things in life? And really, when we think we hear from God or a higher power, it's just our own head, right? Tackle that. I would love for you to speak to that really quick.
Great.
Or however much time you want to take.
Oh, man. I do want to respond to that. Thanks. Yeah, that's a great question. And yeah, great. Okay, here are my thoughts. I have a few. So I realize even just the language I'm using right now, I've already like alienated people or whatever. They're like, okay, this guy's crazy, or I can't relate to that, or that's not Christian or God or whatever. I get that. And so I want to say to the people who hear me say what I'm saying and like have that response, I get it. And that's totally fine. Like, I don't need you to agree with me or believe me. To me, that doesn't matter. Like, these things happen whether you believe me or not, it's fine. But I want to, I guess one thing I do want to say is, I started encountering God in this dramatic, specific fashion, and it happened multiple times before I ever set foot in a charismatic church. So Bethel's a very charismatic environment, right? And I eventually landed there, but I had experiences with God as a Baptist that didn't make sense to my environment. Like, the people around me and the Christians that I knew, the people who like were running next to me, who knew that I was legit and like an amazing Christian, like none of us had these experiences. So when I started telling them about God and these ridiculous, intense exposures I was having to this person of God, I mean, I couldn't not cry because I was so exposed to the nature of God. And I could say this in a different way. Like, even to someone who's not a Christian, I could say, like, I was exposed to the nature of love is probably a fair, accurate, like, translation of this. But for the record, I don't think this is just like love. I think this was like the nature of God, because I've got other friends who are scholars who I respect and their theology is legit, and they're atheists. Like, they don't have a functional relationship with the Holy Spirit. They don't believe in the Holy Spirit. They think that's just terminology for the universe and source energy or like universal love or whatever. They have their other terms. I'm like, that's fine. I actually don't care. That's fine. You can call it whatever you want. I experienced that source energy, universal love, in a very personalized way. That energy source is not indifferent or ambiguous or objective. Like, it is very affectionate and committed and humble and kind and innocent and favorably disposed toward us. I don't know how to talk about God like some depersonalized energy field. Like, that's not my experience. And that's okay. Like, I get other people don't have the experiences I've had, and that's fine. So I respect that. I don't need them to agree, but I'm also not going to pretend like this didn't come to me the way that it did. That I didn't have the experiences that I did. I'm totally open to my upbringing having influence in how I perceived what I'm describing as experiences with God. Sure. But the thing that kind of still messes with me in terms of like trying to level with people there is, I had no training for this. I had no preparation. I had no prior experience. I didn't actually believe that God spoke to people. I had some friends a few years before these experiences started happening that told me they heard God, that God spoke to them. And they would tell me specific phrases they were hearing. And I was like, it kind of rattled me to consider the idea that God would talk to them, that it was that simple. Cause they were just like, oh yeah, you could just tap into them and get it. And I'm like, I basically concluded, I don't believe them. I don't think that God does that. I don't think he's a magic eight ball. I don't think you just like whip up a genie, whatever. So I'm not saying that. This was not just a simple like, oh, I'm in here from God. These experiences I'm describing, I did not pursue. I was not trying to get God to tell me anything. I prayed a bunch to hear from God and didn't hear anything. And then these random, specific, disruptions would happen and they were devastating and they altered my life. Not just the trajectory of where I went, they changed the way that I was. I did not used to be like this. They didn't change my personality, but they changed my temperament. They changed my relationship with reality. These experiences changed how I perceived people. They dissolved a lot of my barriers to like intimacy. Even my physical touch changed because of these experiences. Like I'm way more able to express love physically, like even just with like platonic friendships than I was able to before all this. There's so much that altered about me. I mean, there was like profound spiritual insight I just started having after these experiences that I'm like, and people are flying me all over the world to tell them these things that I know. And I'm like, I don't know how I know this, but it's just very clear to me. This is how this works. This is what this is saying here. They're all my opinion, but there's like, people would recognize like there's weight when you say this. Like, I don't understand what you're saying, but I believe you. I think there's truth here. And I'm like, I agree. How can I better describe this? So I just, my point is like, I don't think I'm just blindly accepting these like overly intense emotional experiences. I've scientifically sat back and assessed because I've had many of them, like these patterns. And I don't believe that I'm making this up. I don't believe that I was like wanting this experience to be a thing in my life. I am telling you, I'm giving an account of things that happened to me in spite of my comprehension or willpower or the level of faith that I had. Like, I don't think I was aware of any of those things as this was happening. So just for what that's worth, if anybody can hear reason as I'm saying that and my own cognitive ability to assess and like be accountable to what I'm describing, I'm telling you, like I have looked at this for so many years and pulled it apart and continued to pay attention. I'm not making this up. This stuff happened. Like God said these things to me and it wasn't, anyway. So I'm going to say that. And then I think there are lots of other ways that God communicates to people. I think that we hear him in lots of ways. I don't think what I'm describing is the only way to hear from God, but I would say, because I've heard from God in lots of other unique and profound and interesting and mysterious ways that aren't like what I'm describing. I would say the things I'm describing were like top tier as far as like power or intensity or impact.
Burning bush moments.
Sure. Yeah. And yeah. I thought the first time I met God, it was like the one moment in my life. I'm like, well, I had one of those moments. Like I had a life-changing moment with God. And then it happened again and again. And this is over 14 years. It didn't happen every day. It was like once, it wasn't a frequency thing. It just like seasons of my life, you know, sure. It would like, I don't, anyway. And people would ask like, how do I know God like that? How can I hear God like that? And I'm like, I don't know how I did. I don't know why. I don't know how. I don't have answers. And I think I'm going to just choose to say I don't know, because anything else I say, I'd have to be making it up. I mean, I have guesses. Like one thing I have found is like, I've noticed in this pattern of encountering the voice of God like this, I think almost every single one of them was preceded by something about my worldview that I was certain about. Got called into question. All of a sudden, I wasn't certain about a foundational pillar, like tenet of my belief about myself, about God, about people, about the world. Something all of a sudden wasn't certain to me anymore. And then very shortly after that moment of being pricked, boom, I'm experiencing the voice of God and it is ruining my life. I would say that is one observable pattern that I think is relevant to why those experiences came the way that it did. I didn't do it on purpose because I've had a lot of other moments where I was uncertain about something and I didn't hear from God, you know? So I'm not saying that was a trigger or that got that to happen, but I think every time I did hear from him like that or experience him in that way, there was a precursor of like, I don't know about this. And then boom. And it wasn't even about the thing I didn't know about. It was just like, God was saying something that I had to wrestle with. And so over time, as I continued to pay attention to all these things that God said, I realized, everything he said to me in all of these moments I'm describing, all of them were always about my sexuality. And I didn't know that. I thought they were unique to the seasons that I was in because the language was mysterious and cryptic and like directional. There was a linear progression to this and the language would continue to intensify and specify as like the later in my life we got. And then when it all came like to a culmination, it was like, oh my gosh, every single one of these moments that I can recall from memory, like recite word for word, because they were burned into my being, man. Like these were some of the most important experiences I've ever had. All of them were pointing to, if I were to translate all of that into a sentence, it would be like God saying to me, Mike, you are gay and I love you that way. And I want you like this. No one's changing this. I want you like this, was the emphatic sentiment that I'm getting from years of exposure to this voice, which is, I think I needed that to be able to make the jump that I did at the place that I was at, right? To give up all of that, my financial and like social security, my prestige, everything I built and worked for was going to go away for me to do this. But I had so much of a foundation of hearing God on this, that that was like way weightier than what I was going to lose. And so I think that's also part of why I felt so much grief, because I had heard from God so many times about this and I still said no. And there were people suffering around me who were being authentic and being honest and being brave about their experiences, and they were suffering for it. And I still just like kept sipping the soup at the Pharaoh's table, just kept benefiting from Egypt while these people are being enslaved. I'm like, I'm so glad I'm not there anymore, but I comfortably lived in that privileged like hypocrisy for years of my life when the voice of God was saying something else to me. I am embarrassed by that. And I'm still like sad that's how I chose to participate. Like that wasn't okay, but you know, like that was my safety. That's how I brokered surviving the trauma I didn't want to have to face of rejection from all of these people I respected. Yeah.
I'm going to ask a weighted question and play somewhat devil's advocate here and ask, why do you think God chose, in the most burning, clear messages that have been given to you in your life, that those were all about your sexuality, not about caring for the poor, loving your neighbor, right? All of the things that God spoke to people in the Bible, or right? We've got all these examples of God speaking to people. Why do you think that those were the things, that was the theme that God spoke to you repeatedly over those years?
Yeah, great question. No one's ever asked me that. Fascinating. I'm gonna need to get this interview from you. I'm just kidding. I think because, well, for one, this is obviously my opinion, but I think because God is so much more personal than we give him credit for. Sorry, and when I say him, I'm trying to like avoid that. I don't think it's actually accurate to refer to God as him or he. I don't think God is a he. So I want to say they. I want to degender the pronoun for God, because I think God is male and female and whatever else. I don't think God is limited to the sex that we've all like. Anyway, so
yep.
I think God is more personable, more personal than we give them credit for. And it sounds weird to say that, because it sounds like I'm depersonalizing God when I say that. Anyway, I'm going to let that go. I think God spoke to me specifically about this because this is such an intensely marginalized and attacked group of people. And there's such a persecution for them specifically in the church walls. And I think that God is responsive to us. I don't think God doesn't care. I think they are representing their heart and passion for people. And for whatever reason, the thing that I've been called to, the thing that I was avoiding and didn't want to face, and is that God cares about queer people. Like, they're not broken. There's not something wrong with them. They're not second-class citizens. God does not treat them or experience them like that. And so for us to be doing this is a crime against them, because they are an expression of the attributes and nature of God. Like, queer people are carrying a unique, creative, intuitive, empathetic, unity-driven, relationship-based attribute that God demonstrates in the world. And if the church would stop oppressing us long enough to just like pay attention to the beauty that queer people bring to the spaces they're in, you would notice distinct patterns of contribution that are overwhelmingly contributed by the queer community. So many worship leaders get kicked out the moment they come out, but they were some of the most anointed people to lead in that capacity within Christian congregations. And it's awkward how many times that happens. How many anointed people are we going to drive out because their sexuality is unacceptable to us? Why are they the ones who are constantly the ones in that position? And then you find out and you kick them out. Why did you promote them in the first place? What were you even saying yes to begin? Anyway, so I think that God cares about gay people, queer people. And so I think they were speaking to me about this because we are absolutely missing it. And I think our capacity to hear the voice of the Lord gets more specific the higher our consciousness gets to become, right? And so when we look at the authors of the Bible, their consciousness was only up to a certain point before they didn't have as much development as we do today. And it's not because we're better than them. We're just further down the road, right? Now, I mean, I'm just talking about like science and like cosmology and just our understanding of the nature of the universe, but also like the word trauma is nowhere in the Bible, but they are speaking to consequences and results that are very much addressing trauma that we have language for now. We get to be way more acute about what we recognize and the cause and effect that we are observing in human life to where this stuff's coming from and the impact that it's having. And that's a huge emphasis within scripture without being able to articulate it. I think because the authors didn't have the verbiage and the audience didn't have the framework to understand it. So when you see Paul or Jesus especially expressing frustration in trying to speak spiritual truth to a limited context or audience, you see Jesus have this moment multiple times where he's like, how long am I going to be saddled with you? You cannot even handle what I'm saying with like natural comparisons. What are you going to do when there's no natural like example that I can refer to for how the kingdom works, right? You see him like wrestling. And then Paul as well.
You're talking about him using metaphorical examples, right? Just to get it through.
Yeah. Like parables or like, so when Nicodemus is like, what, am I going to crawl back into my mother's womb? And Jesus is like, are you freaking kidding me? Right? Like, Nicodemus, you're a teacher of the people and you think I'm talking about physical birth? Like, come on, man. I'm trying to help like connect to your world and what you know. And so anyway, I think with where we are now, the consciousness of humanity, we actually have a grid in our social sciences, in like, you know, genetics, just the things that we've like studied and learned. Maybe it's not as binary. Maybe it's not as black and white. Maybe this isn't as evil or demonic as we've always perceived it. Maybe these variances and this diversity is actually a good thing. If we observe evolution, right, and species and whatever, if being gay was a regressive thing that our species that was needing to work out, why are we still here? Why have queer people been in this population since the ancient of days? And why are we still around? Why is the population of the queer community in America 5.1% of when it was 4.9, like 3 years ago, right? Why is it going up? Why? If we are a recessive trait, if we're something that the species needs to work out, that's a problem, then why are we, just even from a scientific standpoint, forget like the heart of God and all this other stuff that matters, right? So I think God is speaking to me about that because I think collectively we're getting closer to the place where we can actually do the justice work of covering and protecting and embracing these people, even if we don't understand them. We're going to get better and better at understanding queer people, but like, can't we love and embrace them with before that? Can't we demonstrate humility and grace and compassion? Like charity is the word that like the Old Testament, the authors of the New Testament would have written it with like brotherly love. Can't we treat people with that kind of care, even if we don't understand why they're presenting this way? Anyway, so I don't know if I answered the question, but I think.
You absolutely did.
Okay, great.
You know, you and I talked about this when we had lunch a while back, and, you know, I feel like it's the perfect time to talk about it. I'm not always, but sometimes I'm a numbers guy because to help drill in a reality to me. And when I heard you all talk about this, it blew me away as a queer person in the LGBTQ plus community myself. I had no idea that statistic on adolescent suicide rates. Do you remember? Are you able to bring that back up?
It's like, so the suicide rate within the LGBTQ plus community is like higher than the average suicide rate of just the population, right? I don't know what the number is. I think it's like 20 to 40% more. They're more likely to commit suicide if they're queer. Within the queer suicide stat, if the queer person we're talking about is raised in a religious home, the likelihood of that person committing suicide goes up 9 times. They are 9 times more likely to commit suicide if they're raised by a Christian than if they're raised by a non-Christian, which is insane. And the whole like observation we want to take away from this is if Christians have this amazing book of the word of God speaking to them and releasing grace and love into the world, then why is that stat going up for those people as opposed to down? You would think that it would be lower because of the love of Christ that Christians are supposed to be exemplifying in the world and because of the Bible, but no, it goes up. And I think the reason I'm hearing the voice of the Lord in the way that I am, that God is saying what they're saying to me in spite of my own refusal to get on board, is because God isn't condemning these people. God isn't like sending them away. They're not changing the queer community. God loves and embraces and accepts and celebrates, affirms LGBTQ plus people. So that stat is like pretty implicating, you know, it's pretty damning. It's horrible. And it should be sober us right up if we cared, if we actually were paying attention and we like took this seriously and we loved our queer neighbor, that stat alone should stop us in our tracks and force us to like at least double check. Did I miss something? Is there something I haven't understood yet? Why is that a thing? Right. Anyway.
Absolutely. And I mean, you know, if anything, we want to create a better world for those of us who are living in the, you know, reality of being queer people. But even more so, just like I think any good person, we have to live in this space of reality that our efforts now have to also cater towards creating a better world for those who are coming behind us. Totally. And if we don't look at what we're doing and how it affects them, what does that have to say about our humanity?
Totally. Patrick, do not get me started. Totally.
Wow. I feel like we've just really hit a lot of the meat. And we only have so much time, and I feel like we could literally do 6 hours on this, if not more. But so kind of in wrapping up, I wonder if you would flush through what was the process like, having those conversations, moving into the past 2 years, if you were to put bullet point that. And
it was awful in a lot of ways. It was better than I expected in a lot of ways, and then there were other horrible things I did not anticipate that I got surprised by and had to hire a therapist to help me work through.
Without sharing anybody's identity, are you able to share a couple of the stuff that's caught you off guard?
Yeah. So one thing that it does stick out to me still in that process that I was not expecting, and I wish someone could have told me, the people that were close to me before I came out and accepted myself as a gay man, right? These are like deep friendships. These are people who are respectable. They're leaders in their own right. Like we're peers. Like there's such a cool like companionship there. And so a lot of these people knew I struggled with my sexuality before my coming out experience. So when I came out and like the narratives changed and I'm like, hey, I'm actually like changing my mind about this. I have been wrong. I'm not changing. God actually wants me like this, which already sounds crazy to people. I'm like, that they get to deal with that. Mm-hmm. The people in my life who were close to me, who could not figure out how to change that in their minds, who remained unaffirming, they would say to me, Mike, I love you. I care about you. I believe in you. I support you. And they avoided articulating, I don't believe you're supposed to be gay. I don't believe God wants people to be gay. I don't believe God supports this. I don't believe this is biblical. They believe that stuff, but they didn't say it to me. But I started learning through the coming out journey, who is who, where people fell, what they believed, based on how they communicated. You start becoming very acutely aware of communication and how it shows up. And I don't just mean like, oh, I just assumed. I mean, like I've given people lots of opportunity to show up and demonstrate love and care and whatever. And I started noticing a pattern of this particular intersectionality of people in my relationships. The people who are close to me, who are non-affirming, but have like accountability of intimacy with me, they all were happy to keep asking questions about my process. They're happy to listen to what this is like, watch me undress in this vulnerable experience of whatever, and continue to withhold that they actually don't believe what I'm experiencing is from God. They don't believe that what's happening here is holy or good or just or right. They're not affirming of me as a queer man, but they're happy to keep letting me talk about it. And I had to, like, it took a while for me to figure out, like, whoa, that is such a violating experience. I deserved to know that they are not affirming here. And I deserved to have the opportunity, based on that information, to choose not to share further vulnerably about this process. Like, that to me was deceptive and betraying and gross. And they don't have, like, I think the people I'm talking about don't have that expectation in their relationships because they don't know anybody who's had to go through something like this. It's such a unique thing to have to walk through. So in one sense, I can be sympathetic. It's like, oh, I get why they don't get it. But in another sense, if I'm going to advocate for and care for this little gay boy that I've abandoned for most of my life, this is unacceptable. And I will not let him be treated this way. Even if they don't get it and I shouldn't expect them to, I'm still not exposing him to that. He deserves better. And I should have taken care of this a long time ago. So I had to come to terms with realizing that these people don't actually know the full version of me. They know the version of me that I was able to contrive and perform and like present. They don't know the full me. And the only person they're interested in having intimacy with is the fake guy that I used to be. Mm-hmm. They don't want to know or accept or believe in or care for or relate to this person. And I'm like, guess what? That effectively means we are not friends. You don't know me. You don't love me. And they would argue. They would argue and say, how dare you say that? And they, a few of them have actually like gone, I cannot believe this, but they would start listing out in their resume all the ways they've cared for me over the years, all the ways they've proven that they're faithful. And I'm like, is this happening right now? So to me, it just, the scientific part of me is like, oh, this is just showing like this huge disconnect. They don't know what we're talking about. We're not talking about the same thing. They're making this about them. They think me coming out as a gay person and advocating for my well-being is an attack on them, which it's not. They could not connect with me and my experience enough to recognize how traumatizing this is, how harmful this environment and their even their ideology has been to someone like me, the amount of work it's going to take to actually be affirming of someone like me to the degree that they deserve. And they aren't even asking those questions. And so I'm like, oh, I get to make a decision then. How am I going to manage? So that has been the most painful part of this process. I've gotten some horrible comments from people on social media or emails or whatever, friends texting me. Like, I've gotten some horrible stuff. None of that was anywhere near as painful as my friend simply not affirming me in this vulnerable relationship. That was way more painful. And that might be unique to me, maybe not. And I think I'm more intense about this stuff than the average queer person who comes out. But I'm kind of like what you were describing. I'm not just coming out and doing this process just for my own well-being. That's a priority. But another driving force for me is there are a ton of other gay kids who didn't have someone prepare the way for them. I didn't have someone prepare the way for me in the ways that I wish that I could have had. I'm like, I'm not going to go through this and like let this stay the way it was. Other people are going to walk through this and it's going to be better because I went through it. I am going to clear the halls. I'm going to get these demons and bullies and whatever out of here. This stuff's not acceptable. This pathway is going to be different because I went through it. I'm not letting who comes after me have to go through what I just went through. It's going to be different for them somehow, some way. I don't know, but I'm fighting this. It's not going to be like this. This cannot be normal. So I think that has been the most painful part of this. Leaders, like within 24 hours of coming up publicly, I had like every speaking engagement I had scheduled for 2022. They called me up, texted me, whatever, contacted me and canceled or kicked me out of the conference or whatever. And I knew that was going to happen and it sucked having to go through it. I expected it. So it wasn't like shocking, but that sucked. You know, that was really painful. Having important like family members or church leaders be silent, say nothing to me, knowing that they'd seen what I'm going through and what I shared or whatever. Or having like people who are like in ministry, like alongside me in terms of like our tier at Bethel, make comments about me publicly, like post about me without tagging me or saying my name, but just talk about everything that I was saying and going through and like refuting all of it, like, but not actually reaching out to me at all, even though they have my phone number, like they could have contacted me. Just seeing the weird, like how inhuman the process was, even within the church, I was like, this is so gross and so inhuman. And these people are barbaric and they don't even realize how dehumanizing their behavior is. Like, Christians are so detached from what a queer person goes through. It's shocking to me. I don't know. This stuff has been all really painful, some of it more than others, and absolutely traumatizing going through some of this. I've had so many days where someone would send me a text and I just couldn't do stuff for the rest of the day. I like was tiptoeing. I was like crawling through the day emotionally. I just bottomed out and couldn't recover. And I avoided their text for like a couple of weeks. I just couldn't respond without freaking out and getting so mad, so hurt, so betrayed. Am I answering your question?
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't help but think that of you know, as you describe this, you know, you're somewhat held a position of power and influence in you know, that arena of the Christian church, right? And that shifted when this took place. And I say that now, and what you're doing, obviously you have got a new, you're forging a new path and have quite the following on social media and people that connect with you. But something that I think is so cool is that as you've been going through this process, you're using your voice. And you know, I was looking at, as I was putting together my introduction for you, thought leader stuck out to me because it's clear that you are a pastor, a special kind of pastor that is teaching and, you know, and preaching, you know, what you find through your journey, how God speaks to you and everything. But forging a path with the overlay of those two lenses of being a thought leader in addition to, you know, a teacher, preacher, in a new and different kind of way that I have, you're the only person I know who's doing this, you know? And I kept thinking like, God, it like, screw the number of followers. Like that's so superficial, but at the same time, you look at that number of followers and I guarantee you the number of people, because I think about the young Patrick Custer, who, if Instagram had been around when I was going through puberty, and I had somehow gotten across your profile, there's no way I would have followed you, but I guarantee you I would have been typing your name into the search bar every single day to look at your profile and watch your reels and watch your stories and everything, right? Because you can't afford to let someone be seen. My whole point is like this platform that you have and the way that you're using it is reaching people far beyond, I think, what you'll ever know and understand. And I kind of wanted to take that thread that you were weaving about God talking to you and using his voice like all those times and, you know, bring it full circle to the place of, you know, there are so many unknowns. There's unknowns in faith. There's unknowns when we're talking about hearing the source energy, the voice of God, whatever. You know, you talked about how do I know that it was the voice of God? I don't know. How can I tell you that you can figure out how to hear the voice of God? I don't necessarily know. Being able to say, I don't know, is, I think, one of the most spiritual and close places we can get to source power, source energy, God, higher power. Sure. When I, as a man, a human being, start trying to put a box around all of this and say, this is the way, the one way, and you have to look at it through this one specific lens or you're not right. And you're not, you know, at that point, I think we start to veer off the path from a real spiritual experience and genuine authenticity and connection. And so my thoughts on all things that we were just talking about, you know, and like I said, that thread that's just being woven through your real life story of, gosh, vulnerability, and I'm excited to see what it continues to do.
Same. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
So how are you taking care of that little gay boy? Mike, today.
Yeah, thanks.
And loving him and doing what you need to help him thrive.
Yeah, lots of things. And I've had to get really intentional about my self-care specifically because of all this. There's a beautiful park near my neighborhood that I go to. I ride a bike and like get to a certain part of the area that no one gets to, and I just walk around in the woods. I just need to get in nature. That's always been true for me my whole life, but I've had to be really intentional about that in this season. So I go out and do that often. I got a therapist in my life, so someone helped me kind of, you know, look at this stuff. So that's helpful for sure. I absolutely started establishing strong, socially awkward boundaries with people in my life, relationships, and like putting some new expectations and requirements for a relationship in my life. Like I refuse to have anybody in a vulnerable part of my life who's not affirming. I will not have anybody who's questioning whether gay people are valid or not. I'm like, yeah, that's fine. You can think that that's fine. I'm not judging you for it. You're just not going to be close to me. I'm not doing it. I can help you and whatever, but I'm not going to call that friendship. I will help you as like, I'll be a kind human being who will throw you a bone and help you do work you should have done a long time ago. Sure. I'll help in step in that way. And I'm not going to be condescending about it, but we're not friends. You don't see me. You don't know me. You're not ready to be friends with me. You don't see me as a human yet. And that's a bummer for you. I'm not paying for it with my vitality, with my well-being. That's my stance. I don't think everyone has to function that way, but I cannot undo this based on the complicity that I've suffered from for letting people be there regarding me. So that's a new boundary. So my point in saying that all that is boundaries is a very intense and important self-care regimen that I've put in place to help not have to deal with all the crazy stuff that's come after. Another thing I functionally do, It's a little bit entertaining. It's shocking. It's educational. But I think for me, it's therapeutic. The nasty, bigoted, ignorant comments I get from people because I'm gay or because of what I'm saying, I will throw on my Instagram story. So if you guys are bored and you just want to like see what's going on in the queer conversation, check out my Instagram stories. There's often content there to like just be baffled by. But that that's is a therapeutic. Thanks. Yeah, it's a circus to say the least. Mm-hmm. But that's a therapeutic process of self-care for me, where I'm not letting this stuff get internalized. I'm not going to like quietly and in a solitary place like witness this. I'm going to let everyone who's going through this journey with me look at it too, and they get to like protest and they get to share their thoughts and comments. And that's actually really helpful for me to get to hear other people also recognize how heinous and disgusting some of these comments are. And also just waking people up to like giving visibility to this experience. And like, do you guys see how dehumanizing this is? Like, can you believe that Christians say this to people? It's unbelievable, but it's still happening. Like, these people are publishing these comments publicly. Other people can see their names attached to this rhetoric and they're still sharing it. It's unbelievable. So I think that's another specific way that I've learned how to wield this. And I didn't know how to do it at first. I didn't want to call people out. I didn't want to like showcase this stuff. So I didn't do it a lot. But I've started to need to in order to survive the onslaught, just the avalanche of like hate that comes here. And I found it to be quite functional. So I've had so many hateful comments. People are like, are you okay? And 2 months ago, I would have so appreciated the check-in. I would have been like, I am not okay. I would have talked, you know. Now I'm like, actually, I am. I'm doing great because this is absurd to me. And me sharing it in this way has allowed me to remain separate from it and not take it personally. This has nothing to do with it. And so that's been a huge helpful like tool in my process. I'm doing a lot of research. I'm reading a ton of books. I'm just learning a lot of new things I was never allowed to learn. And that has also been very helpful for my self-care process, you know, just like getting to disempower hateful, toxic theology that I was raised under. So it's like these things, I'm doing all this stuff like on a pretty regular basis in the intervals that they need to be happening in. I'm watching a lot of great shows and movies. I'm hanging out with friends. You know, we're getting food. We're playing games. Like, I'm doing all those things. And I'm doing great. Like, I was not doing great a couple months ago. Like, it was like kind of a scary, weird, dark spot there for a second. I feel great. I'm looking forward to getting further out of the hole that I've been climbing out of. But I'm quite pleased with where I am emotionally at this point. Like, there's definitely been an improvement, which is a win.
I love hearing that.
Thank you.
Awesome. Oh, Mike, this has been such a, I feel like all my conversations on here are special, but this one really hits home so heavy for me. And I can't thank you enough, because this has just meant, this conversation has meant a whole lot, and gotten me, it gets me inspired and really fired up to talk about this. And, you know, it's a little different than my normal convos that I'm having. So I just want to say in closing, ask you, you know, to that person who's tuning in, says, this is me, he's talking about my story, what would be your final word of encouragement to that individual?
Yeah, I'm assuming that individual is a Christian of some kind. And if not, that's totally fine. But I want to say to that person, listen, it doesn't matter what anyone else says or thinks. I've like been there with this person that we call God. God loves you. I'm not saying that as a cliche Christian trope. I'm not saying that because of what I see in the Bible. I'm saying that because of who I've encountered God to be. And God was telling me this before I was okay with it. God loves you, fully accepts you. There is nothing wrong with you. There's a lot wrong with the world, and the struggle and suffering that people like us have to go through is the fault of our majority. It's not the fault of you. This is not anything that you've done wrong. You're awesome. You're beautiful. And you actually carry a very unique and specific facet of who God is. And we need you in this world. We need your voice. We need your experiences. We need your perspective. We need your talents. We need your skills and your gifts and your experiences. You are an integral, necessary part of what the Bible describes as the body of Christ. We need you. And we're going to learn from you. And you're going to tell us and show us things. You're going to demonstrate stuff for us about God that we've never seen before. And it's so sad how many people have not been able to bring that to the table because of what we've done to them. And I hope that whatever work I'm doing here and contribution I'm bringing to this space, that it creates opportunity and space for people like you to happen and to show us your unique version of glory that you carry. you're left.
That's beautiful. Mike, thank you so much.
Totally. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Absolutely. And with that, I'll close out how I always do and remind everyone that it is never too late to start loving yourself, and you are only one decision away from a completely different life.
For more information on today's episode, check out the show notes. Recovery Stories is brought to you by Promises Behavioral Health's Rooted Alumni Community. If you or a loved one are struggling, have questions, or ready to take the next step, call our admission center at 888-648-4098. Or visit us online at www.promisesbehavioralhealth.com. Our team is ready and waiting to answer the call for help. Whether you're watching on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, or listening on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, please share with your friends, follow, subscribe, and leave us a review. We are grateful for you and hope that you have been encouraged by today's episode. As always, remember you are only one decision away from a completely different life, and it is never too late to start loving yourself.